They are the Pishakas, the incubi and succubi of medieval times, the demons of thirst, gluttony, lust and avarice, elementaries of intensified graft, wickedness and cruelty, provoking their victims to horrid crimes, and reveling in their commission. Soldiers' guild in battle do not quite come under this category, because, whether the cause for which they are fighting be in the abstract right or wrong, they think it to be right. To them it is the call of duty, and they sacrifice their lives, willingly and unselfishly. In spite of its horrors, therefore, war may nevertheless be a potent factor in evolution at a certain level. This, also, is the grain of truth in the idea of the Muhammadan fanatic that the man who dies fighting for the faith goes straight to a very good life in the next world. In the case of children dying young, it is unlikely that they will have developed much affinity for the lowest subdivisions of the astral world, and as a matter of experience they are seldom found on the lowest astral subplanes. Some people cling so desperately to material existence that at death their astral bodies cannot altogether separate from the etheric, and consequently they awaken still surrounded by etheric matter. Such persons are in a very unpleasant condition. They are shut out from the astral world by the etheric shell which surrounds them, and at the same time they are, page 142, also, of course, shut off from ordinary physical life because they have no physical sense organs. The result is that they drift about, lonely, dumb and terrified, unable to communicate with entities on either plane. They cannot realize that if they would only let go their frenzied grasp on matter they would slip, after a few moments of unconsciousness, into the ordinary life of the astral plane. But they cling to their gray world, with their miserable half-consciousness, rather than sink into what they think complete extinction, or even the hell in which they have been taught to believe. In process of time the etheric shell wears out, and the ordinary course of nature reasserts itself in spite of their struggles. Sometimes in sheer desperation they recklessly let themselves go, preferring even the idea of annihilation to their present existence, with a result overwhelmingly and surprisingly pleasant. In a few cases, another astral entity may be able to help them by persuading them to let go their hold on what to them is life and sink out of it. In other cases, they may be so unfortunate as to discover a means of reviving to some extent their touch with physical life through a medium, though as a rule the medium spirit guide very properly forbids them access. The guide is right in his action, because such entities, in their terror and need, become quite unscrupulous and would obsess and even madden a medium, fighting as a drowning man fights for life. They could succeed only if the ego of the medium had weakened his hold upon his vehicles by allowing the indulgence of undesirable thoughts or passions. Sometimes an entity may be able to seize upon a baby body, ousting the feeble personality for whom it was intended, or sometimes even to obsess the body of an animal, the fragment of the group soul which, to an animal, stands in the place of an ego, having a hold on the body less strong than that of an ego. This obsession may be complete or partial. The obsessing, page 143, entity thus once more gets into touch with the physical plane, sees through the animal's eyes, and feels any pain inflicted upon the animal. In fact, so far as his own consciousness is concerned, he is the animal for the time being. A man who thus entangles himself with an animal cannot abandon the animal's body at will, but only gradually and by considerable effort, extending probably over many days. Usually he is set free only at the death of the animal, and even then there remains an astral entanglement to shake off. After the death of the animal, such a soul sometimes endeavors to obsess another member of the same herd, or indeed any other creature whom he can seize in his desperation. The animals most commonly seized upon seem to be the less developed ones, cattle, sheep and swine. More intelligent creatures, such as dogs, cats and horses do not appear to be so easily dispossessed, though cases do occasionally occur. All obsessions, whether of a human or an animal body, are an evil and a hindrance to the obsessing soul, as they temporarily strengthen his hold upon the material, and so delay his natural progress into the astral life, besides making undesirable karmic links. In the case of a man who, by vicious appetite or otherwise, forms a very strong link with any type of animal, his astral body shows animal characteristics, and may resemble in appearance the animal whose qualities had been encouraged during earth life. In extreme cases, the man may be linked to the astral body of the animal and thus be chained as a prisoner to the animal's physical body. The man is conscious in the astral world, has his human faculties, but cannot control the animal body nor express himself through that body on the physical plane. The animal organism serves as a jailer, rather than as a vehicle, and, further, the animal soul is not ejected, but remains as the proper tenant of its body. Cases of this kind explain, at least partially, the belief often found in Oriental countries, that a man, page 144, may under certain conditions reincarnate in an animal body. A similar fate may befall a man as he returns to the astral plane on his way to rebirth, and is described in chapter 24 on rebirth. The class of person who is definitely held down to earth by anxiety is often termed earthbound. As Saint Martin expressed it, such men are remainers, not returners, being unable thoroughly to tear themselves away from physical matter until some business is settled in which they have a special interest. We have already seen that after physical death a real man is steadily withdrawing himself from his outer bodies, and that, in particular, manas, or mind, endeavors to disentangle itself from karma, or desire. In certain rare cases, the personality, or lower man, may be so strongly controlled by karma that lower manas is completely enslaved and cannot disentangle itself. The link between the lower and the higher mental, the silver thread that binds it to the master, snaps in two. This is spoken of in occultism as the loss of the soul. It is the loss of the personal self, which had separated from its parent, the higher ego, and has thus doomed itself to perish. In such a case, even during earth life, the lower quaternary is wrenched away from the triad, that is, the lower principles, headed by lower manas, are severed from the higher principles, Atma, Buddhi and higher manas. The man is rent in twain. The brute has broken itself free, and it goes forth unbridled, carrying with it the reflections of that manasic light which should have been its guide through life. Such a creature, owing to its possession of mind, is more dangerous even than an unevolved animal, though human in form, it is brute in nature, without sense of truth, love or justice. After physical death, such an astral body is an entity of terrible potency, and is unique in this, that under certain rare conditions it can reincarnate in the world of men. With no instincts save those of the, page 145, animal, driven only by passion, never even by emotion, with a cunning that no brute can rival, a wickedness that is deliberate, it touches ideal vileness, and is the natural foe of all normal human beings. A being of this class, which is known as an elementary, sinks lower with each successive incarnation, until, as the evil force gradually wears itself out, it perishes, being cut off from the source of life. It disintegrates, and thus as a separate existence is lost. From the point of view of the ego, there has been no harvest of useful experience from that personality, the ray has brought nothing back. The lower life has been a total and complete failure. The word elementary has been employed by various writers in many different senses, but it is recommended that it be confined to the entity described above. Chapter 16. The Astral Plane. This chapter will be confined, so far as the complexities of the subject permit, to a description of the nature, appearance, properties, etc., of the astral plane or world. A later chapter will be devoted to an enumeration and description of the entities which live in the astral world. The intelligent student will recognize the extreme difficulty of giving in physical language an adequate description of the astral world. The task has been compared to that of an explorer of some unknown tropical forest being asked to give a full account of the country through which he has passed. The difficulties of describing the astral world are further complicated by two factors: I, the difficulty of correctly translating from the astral to the physical plane the recollection of what has been seen, and, two, the inadequacy of physical plane language to express much of what has to be reported. One of the most prominent characteristics of the astral world is that it is full of continually changing shapes. We find there not only thought forms, composed of elemental essence and animated by a thought, but also vast masses of elemental essence from which continually shapes emerge and into which they again disappear. The elemental essence exists in hundreds of varieties on every subplane, as through the air were visible and were in constant undulating motion with changing colors like mother of pearl. Currents of thought are continually thrilling through this astral matter, strong thoughts persisting as entities for a long time, weak ones clothing themselves in elemental essence and wavering out again. Page 147. We have already seen that astral matter exists in seven orders of fineness, corresponding to the seven physical grades of solid, liquid, gaseous, etc. Each of these seven orders of matter is the basis of one of the seven levels, subdivisions, or subplanes, as they are variously called, of the astral plane. It has become customary to speak of these seven levels as being ranged one above the other, the densest at the bottom and the finest at the top, and in many diagrams they are actually drawn in this manner. There is a basis of truth in this method of representation, but it is not the whole truth. The matter of each subplane interpenetrates that of the subplane below it. Consequently, at the surface of the earth, all seven subplanes exist together in the same space. Nevertheless, it is also true that the higher astral subplanes extend further away from the physical earth than the lower subplanes. A very fair analogy of the relation between the astral subplanes exists in the physical world. To a considerable extent, liquids interpenetrate solids. For example, water is found in soil, gases interpenetrate liquids, water usually contains considerable volumes of air, and so on. Nevertheless, it is substantially true that the bulk of the liquid matter of the earth lies in seas, rivers, etc., above the solid earth. Similarly, the bulk of gaseous matter rests above the surface of the water, and reaches much further out into space than either solid or liquid. Similarly with astral matter. By far the densest aggregation of astral matter lies within the limits of the physical sphere. In this connection, it should be noted that astral matter obeys the same general laws as physical matter, and gravitates towards the center of the earth. The seventh or lowest astral subplane penetrates some distance into the interior of the earth, so that the entities living on it may find themselves actually within the crust of the earth. The sixth subplane is partially coincident with the surface of the earth. Page 148. The third subplane, which the spiritualists call the Summerland, extends many miles up into the atmosphere. The outer limit of the astral world extends nearly to the mean distance of the moon's orbit, so that at perigee the astral planes of the earth and moon usually touch one another, but not at apogee. N.B. The earth and moon are nearly 240,000 miles apart, hence the name the Greeks gave to the astral plane, the sublunar world. It follows that at certain times of the month astral communication with the moon is possible, but not at certain other times. A case, in fact, recorded where a man reached the moon, but had to wait till communication was re-established by the approach of the satellite to its primary before he could return. The seven subdivisions fall naturally into three groups: A, the seventh or lowest; B, the sixth, fifth and fourth; and C, the third, second and first. The difference between members of one group may be compared to that between two solids, for example, steel and sand. The difference between the groups may be compared to that between a solid and a liquid. Subplane 7 has the physical world as its background, though only a distorted and partial view of it is visible, since all that is light and good and beautiful seems invisible. 4,000 years ago the scribe Ani described it in an Egyptian papyrus thus, "What manner of place is this unto which I have come? It hath no water, it hath no air, it is deep, unfathomable, it is black as the blackest night, and men wander helplessly about therein. In it a man may not live in quietness of heart." For the unfortunate human being on that level, it is indeed true that all the earth is full of darkness and cruel habitation, but it is darkness which radiates from within himself and causes his existence to be passed in a perpetual night of evil and horror, a very real hell, though, like all other hells, entirely of man's own creation. Page 149. Most students find the investigation of this section an extremely unpleasant task, for there appears to be a sense of density and gross materiality about it which is indescribably loathsome to the liberated astral body, causing it the sense of pushing its way through some black, viscous fluid, while the inhabitants and the influences encountered there are also usually exceedingly undesirable. The ordinary decent man would probably have little to detain him on the seventh subplane, the only persons who would normally awake to consciousness on that subplane being those whose desires are gross and brutal, drunkards, sensualists, violent criminals, and the like. Subplane 6, 5 and 4 have for their background the physical world with which we are familiar. Life on number 6 is like ordinary physical life, minus the physical body and its necessities. Nose. 5 and 4 are less material and more withdrawn from the lower world and its interests. As in the case of the physical, the densest astral matter is far too dense for the ordinary forms of astral life, but the astral world has other forms of its own which are quite unknown to students of the surface. On the fifth and fourth subplanes, merely earthly associations appear to become of less and less importance, and the people there tend more and more to mold their surroundings into agreement with the more persistent of their thoughts. Subplanes 3, 2 and 1, though occupying the same space, give the impression of being further removed from the physical world and correspondingly less material. At these levels entities lose sight of the earth and its affairs. They are usually deeply self-absorbed, and to a large extent create their own surroundings, though these are sufficiently objective to be perceptible to other entities. They are thus little awake to the realities of the plane, but live instead in imaginary cities of their own, partly creating them entirely by their own thoughts, page 150, and partly inheriting and adding to the structures created by their predecessors. Here are found the happy hunting grounds of the Red Indian, the Valhalla of the Norseman, the hurry-filled paradise of the Muslim, the golden and jeweled-gated New Jerusalem of the Christian, the Lyceum-filled heaven of the materialistic reformer. Here is also the summerland of the spiritualists, in which exist houses, schools, cities, etc., which, real enough as they are for a time, to a clearer sight are sometimes pitiably unlike what their delighted creators suppose them to be. Nevertheless, many of the creations are of real though temporary beauty, and a visitor who knew of nothing higher might wander contentedly among the natural scenery provided, which at any rate is much superior to anything in the physical world, or he might, of course, prefer to construct his scenery to suit his own fancies. The second subplane is especially the habitat of the selfish or unspiritual religionist. Here he wears his golden crown and worships his own grossly material representation of the particular deity of his country and time. The first subplane is specially appropriated to those who during earth life have devoted themselves to materialistic but intellectual pursuits, following them not for the sake of benefiting their fellow men, but either from motives of selfish ambition or simply for the sake of intellectual exercise. Such persons may remain on this subplane for many years, happy in working out their intellectual problems, but doing no good to anyone, and making but little progress on their way towards the heaven world. On this, the atomic subplane, men do not build themselves imaginary conceptions, as they do at lower levels. Thinkers and the men of science often utilize for purposes of their study almost all the powers of the entire astral plane, for they are able to descend almost to the physical along certain limited lines. Thus they can swoop down upon the astral counterpart of A, page 151, physical book and extract from it the information they require. They readily touch the mind of an author, impress their ideas upon him, and receive his in return. Sometimes they seriously delay their departure for the heaven world by the avidity with which they prosecute lines of study and experiment on the astral plane. Although we speak of astral matter as solid, it is never really, but only relatively solid. One of the reasons why medieval alchemists symbolized astral matter by water was because of its fluidity and penetrability. The particles in the densest astral matter are further apart, relatively to their size, than even gaseous particles. Hence it is easier for two of the densest astral bodies to pass through each other than it would be for the lightest gas to diffuse itself in the air. People on the astral plane can and do pass through one another constantly, and through fixed astral objects. There can never be anything like what we mean by a collision, and under ordinary circumstances to bodies which interpenetrate are not even appreciably affected. If, however, the interpenetration lasts for some time, as when two persons sit side by side in a church or theater, a considerable effect may be produced. If a man thought of a mountain as an obstacle, he could not pass through it. To learn that it is not an obstacle is precisely the object of one part of what is called the test of earth. An explosion on the astral plane might be temporarily as disastrous as an explosion of gunpowder on the physical plane, but the astral fragments would quickly collect themselves again. Thus there cannot be an accident on the astral plane in our sense of the word, because the astral body, being fluidic, cannot be destroyed or permanently injured, as the physical can. A purely astral object could be moved by means of an astral hand, if one wished, but not the astral counterpart of a physical object. In order to move an astral, page 152, counterpart, it would be necessary to materialize a hand and move the physical object, then the astral counterpart would, of course, accompany it. The astral counterpart is there because the physical object is there, just as the scent of a rose fills a room because the rose is there. One could no more move a physical object by moving its astral counterpart than one could move the rose by moving its perfume. On the astral plane one never touches the surface of anything, so as to feel it hard or soft, rough or smooth, hot or cold, but on coming into contact with the interpenetrating substance one would be conscious of a different rate of vibration, which might, of course, be pleasant or unpleasant, stimulating or depressing. Thus if one is standing on the ground, part of one's astral body interpenetrates the ground under one's feet, but the astral body would not be conscious of the fact by anything corresponding to a sense of hardness or by any difference in the power of movement. On the astral plane one has not the sense of jumping over a precipice, but simply of floating over it. Although the light of all planes comes from the sun, yet the effect which it produces on the astral plane is entirely different from that on the physical. In the astral world there is a diffused luminosity, not obviously coming from any special direction. All astral matter is in itself luminous, though an astral body is not like a painted sphere, but rather a sphere of living fire. It is never dark in the astral world. The passing of a physical cloud in front of the sun makes no difference whatever to the astral plane, nor, of course, does the shadow of the earth which we call night. As astral bodies are transparent, there are no shadows. Atmospheric and climatic conditions make practically no difference to work on the astral and mental planes. But being in a big city makes a great difference, on account of the masses of thought forms. On the astral plane there are many currents which tend to carry about persons who are lacking in will, page 153, and even those who have will but do not know how to use it. There is no such thing as sleep in the astral world. It is possible to forget upon the astral plane just as it is on the physical. It is perhaps even easier to forget on the astral plane than on the physical because that world is so busy and so populous. Knowledge of a person in the astral world does not necessarily mean knowledge of him in the physical world. The astral plane has often been called the realm of illusion, not that it is itself any more illusory than the physical world, but because of the extreme unreliability of the impressions brought back from it by the untrained seer. This can be accounted for mainly by two remarkable characteristics of the astral world. 1. Many of its inhabitants have a marvelous power of changing their forms with protean rapidity, and also of casting practically unlimited glamour over those with whom they choose to sport, and, 2. Astral sight is very different from and much more extended than physical vision. Thus with astral vision an object is seen, as it were, from all sides at once, every particle in the interior of a solid being is plainly open to the view as those on the outside, and everything entirely free from the distortion of perspective. If one looked at a watch astrally, one would see the face and all the wheels lying separately, but nothing on the top of anything else. Looking at a closed book, one would see each page, not through all the other pages before or behind it, but looking straight down upon it as though it were the only page to be seen. It is easy to see that under such conditions even the most familiar objects may at first be totally unrecognizable, and that an inexperienced visitor may well find considerable difficulty in understanding what he really does see, and still more in translating his vision into the very inadequate language of ordinary speech. Yet a moment's consideration will show that astral, page 154, vision approximates much more closely to true perception than does physical sight, which is subject to the distortions of perspective. In addition to these possible sources of error, matters are still further complicated by the fact that this astral sight cognizes forms of matter which, while still purely physical, are nevertheless invisible under ordinary conditions. Such, for example, are the particles composing the atmosphere, all the emanations which are continuously being given out by everything that has life, and also the four grades of etheric matter. Further, astral vision discloses to view other and entirely different colors beyond the limits of the ordinary visible spectrum. The ultra-red and ultraviolet rays known to physical science being plainly visible to astral sight. Thus, to take a concrete example, a rock, seen with astral sight, is no mere inert mass of stone. With astral vision, 1. The whole of the physical matter is seen, instead of a very small part of it, 2. The vibrations of the physical particles are perceptible, 3. The astral counterpart, composed of various grades of astral matter, all in constant motion, is visible, 4. The universal life, prana, is seen to be circulating through it and radiating from it, 5. An aura will be seen surrounding it, 6. Its appropriate elemental essence is seen permeating it, ever active but ever fluctuating. In the case of the vegetable, animal, and human kingdoms, the complications are naturally much more numerous. A good instance of the sort of mistake that is likely to occur on the astral plane is the frequent reversal of any number which the seer has to record, so that he is liable to render, say, 139 as 931, and so on. In the case of a student of occultism trained by a capable master, such a mistake would be impossible, except through great hurry or carelessness, since such a pupil has to go through a long and varied course of instruction in this art of seeing correctly. A trained seer in time acquires a certainty and confidence in dealing with the, page 155, phenomena of the astral plane far exceeding anything possible in physical life. It is quite a mistaken view to speak with scorn of the astral plane and to think it unworthy of attention. It would, of course, certainly be disastrous for any student to neglect his higher development, and to rest satisfied with the attainment of astral consciousness. In some cases it is indeed possible to develop the higher mental faculties first, to overleap the astral plane for the time, as it were. But this is not the ordinary method adopted by the masters of wisdom with their pupils. For most, progress by leaps and bounds is not practicable. It is necessary therefore to proceed slowly, step by step. In the voice of the silence, three halls are spoken of. The first, that of ignorance, is the physical plane. The second, the hall of learning, is the astral plane, and is so called because the opening of the astral chakrams reveals so much more than is visible on the physical plane that the man feels he is much nearer the reality of the thing. Nevertheless, it is still but the place of probation, a relearning.